It's The Takeaway for Thursday, September 28th, 2017.
About getting America going again and growing again, providing jobs and opportunity here rather than overseas.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that is all about more jobs, fairer taxes, and bigger paychecks for American families. This is a now-or-never moment.
We're going to cut taxes for the middle class, make the tax code simpler and more fair for everyday Americans.
Taxes! Beautiful, lovely taxes!
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're glad to have you with us today. The new fiscal year starts this weekend. Let's talk about your taxes.
Thank you very much. You just want massive tax cuts. That's what you want. That's the only reason you're going so wild.
That's President Trump tempting a crowd of supporters in Indianapolis yesterday after Republicans unveiled the outlines of a proposal for the biggest tax overhaul in a generation.
Democrats and Republicans in Congress should come together, finally, to deliver this giant win for the American people and begin middle-class miracle. It's called a middle-class miracle.
Well, the president's middle-class miracle is currently a 9-page outline that includes reduced rates for most middle-class taxpayers, fewer tax brackets, simpler filing, but also big tax cuts for corporations, an elimination of the estate tax that's paid by the wealthiest Americans, and lots of other goodies too. But more important than what's in this 9-page outline is what's not in it. Congress now has to come up with the detailed plan for this tax overhaul. And Republicans, they are desperate to get this right and not have it go the way of the failed Obamacare repeal. Here to break down what is in the plan is Kelsey Snell, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Kelsey, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Kelsey, 9 pages is actually not super detailed when it comes to $1.5 trillion tax cut. What do we actually know about what Republicans want to do here?
Sure. What they say that they the biggest takeaway that they want people to look at their 9 pages and say, oh, this is what is happening to me, is that they're going to be lower rates for a lot of people. So they're taking 7 current tax brackets and breaking them down to 3, 12%, 25%, and 35%. And they're going to lower the corporate rate from 35% to 20%. Now, that's a big difference. That is a big difference, and those are big tax cuts. And so I think it's not a mistake that the president is focusing on the cuts themselves. But they're also talking about getting rid of most parts of the itemized deduction. So if you happen to own a house, you would still get your tax break. But it's not clear what would happen if you pay student loans and you get a tax break for the interest you pay on those loans. Or what would happen, there are myriad other tax breaks that have gone unmentioned in this plan, including the state and local tax break, which is really important to people who live in big cities and big states like New York, California, and Illinois. A lot of people deduct thousands of dollars each year just from the state and local tax deduction alone.
So they'll have to wait and see how their taxes go down in this plan, if they do at all. You mentioned those 3 tax brackets. The top one you mentioned was 35%. There has been a lot of debate among Republicans about whether they want to cut taxes from 39% down to 35% for the richest people in this country.
Yeah, and one thing that they haven't been mentioning is a part of the reason that the tax bracket is at 39.6 for the top earners right now is because there's a surtax from the Affordable Care Act. And that was a surtax that was placed on the highest earners because there was an idea in the Obama administration that that would help pay for some health services for basically anybody who was getting insurance on the individual market. Now, they don't say this explicitly, but it appears that that tax would go away. And that's part of those tax breaks for the upper income brackets.
Let's talk a little bit about winners and losers also here. You mentioned a little bit about what's going to happen to middle income earners. I mentioned the estate tax, Kelsey Snell, in my intro there, paid by really only the richest Americans. What's the balance that congressional Republicans and the president are envisioning between tax relief for the very wealthiest people and some of those breaks that you described that middle income earners might get?
Yeah, so I spent some time talking to the Ways and Means Committee Chairman Kevin Brady yesterday after this big announcement, and he said that it is unfair that Democrats are kind of casting this as a big loss for lower income people. He's saying that, you know, people who are in the middle and in the lower brackets actually will see their taxes cut too, and in part because they're going to be doubling the standard deduction. So people will see an across-the-board increase in their first pass at deductions, and that they won't need to itemize because they will already, you know, they will already be seeing big tax cuts. It's not entirely certain how that will work out, though, because, again, we're only seeing 9 pages, and the tax code right now is thousands of pages. We often see lawmakers paraded out there in big stacks and books of paper, but that's, I mean, 9 pages cannot rival that at this point.
No, it can't. And those thousands of pages of the tax code, Kelsey Snell, each one of those 1,000 pages has 100 lobbyists dedicated to getting money for their clients from each of those pages. What happens when the lobbyists are unleashed on this process? Every loophole, every little exemption is worth millions of dollars, hundreds of millions to somebody. This is going to happen, right?
Yeah, that is why we say tax reform is hard, and winners and losers of tax reform often bring it down. So we're expecting that the lobbyists have all been involved in this process to begin with. To be clear, that they have not walked away from trying to get Congress to bend to their wishes. But they will be in every congressperson's office. They will be showing up, they will be making phone calls, and they will be doing their best to make sure that the tax breaks for their constituents stick around. So be that corporate breaks, or there are plenty of lobbyists for the charitable tax deduction, or for the mortgage interest deduction, or for real estate developers. If there is a tax deduction out there, there is somebody who's getting paid a lot of money to make sure that it sticks around.
And as I mentioned, Kelsey Snell, before we let you go, I mean, Republicans are desperate to get this plan passed and to get it right. They're stung by the failure of their ACA repeal effort. But this isn't going to be easy, as you mentioned. How hard is it for this broad Republican coalition that's running Congress and the White House now to make sure they get something passed and get this tax cut done?
Sure. I think there is a huge political imperative for Republicans to get this done. As I talked to lawmakers yesterday, they were all saying that this is their goal. It is a much more natural political space for Republicans to talk about cutting taxes than it is for them to talk about reforming health care. Healthcare has never been a big issue for Republicans, and so it was not always the easiest fit. This is right in the sweet spot of a lot of people in the Republican Party. I will say, though, that there are lots of people who are not entirely certain that they're comfortable with giving tax breaks to the wealthy. There are a lot of people who aren't entirely certain that it's okay to get rid of these tax breaks. They agree in the broad strokes of what tax reform should do, but I wouldn't be surprised, and people shouldn't be surprised, if this looks like it has died 1,000 times before it passes, if it passes. It's going to be difficult, and the committees are going to do some serious battle over what is actually included in those extra, you know, 1,000 pages of this plan.
Republicans will spend the rest of this year trying to get this big tax cut and tax reform passed. Kelsey Snell, Washington Post, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, at the beginning of President Trump's tax speech yesterday, he made sure to thank 2 people in the audience.
I also want to thank members of my economic team, Secretary Steven Mnuchin and Director Gary Cohn, for joining us as well. We appreciate it.
Now, behind the scenes, former Goldman Sachs executives Gary Cohn and Steve Mnuchin, who you heard the president mention there, have been crafting this new tax plan. Gary Cohn is President Trump's top economic advisor. Here he is on Fox Business earlier this month.
We are spending 100% of our time on taxes and tax reform, tax simplification. We believe this is the most important thing we can do to drive the U.S. economy, drive economic growth, drive prosperity, and drive wages. And that's what the president promised.
Gary Rivlin is an investigative fellow at the Investigative Fund. He's been tracking Gary Cohn's role in the White House for The Intercept. Gary, welcome.
Thank you.
Gary, the Republican Party today is basically torn between the conservative populists and nationalists like Steve Bannon and the corporatists like say, Paul Ryan. Which side is happier to have Gary Cohn leading tax policy at the White House?
Oh, certainly the corporatists. Gary Cohn was an opponent of Steve Bannon and anyone on the more conservative economic nationalist side of things, much to their chagrin. In the first place, Donald Trump named Gary Cohn, former president of Goldman Sachs, as his chief economic advisor.
So Gary Cohn, chief former executive, Goldman Sachs, corporatist, been accused of being a Democrat by lots of people on
the right. He is a Democrat.
He is a Democrat. Not registered. Accused of being a Democrat, is a Democrat. So he's also called, you know, a globalist with all of the implications that come with that epithet for the right. Is there a risk for President Trump and his political base in having Democrat, globalist, corporatist Gary Cohn in charge here?
See, but to me, taxes is one place where it all comes together, cutting taxes. Gary Cohn's priority from the start, it was back in April that he and Secretary Mnuchin stood up and released their then one-page proposal. Now it's a nine-page framework. Then it was a one-page framework. And his goal from the start had been to slash corporate taxes. And his plan, their plan, was to cut it from 35%, which it is right now, to 15%. This plan unveiled yesterday cuts it down to 20%. But I don't think he's going to get any argument from the non-globalist, the Steve Bannon wing of the Trump administration on that front. There might be pushback on the personal income tax. Bannon raised hackles when he talked about creating a new higher bracket around 45% to tax the ultra wealthy. But on corporate taxes, I think all of the Trump White House is united in favor of that.
And there are already these fights behind the scenes about what to do about top earners, 39% versus 35%. How big should that corporate rate be, as you mentioned? Do you see Gary Cohn's fingerprints across this nine-page plan? And are they fingerprints that the president's political base eventually are going to live with?
Well, the first part of that question, certainly. Again, corporate taxes was the main priority. If this tax plan had taken effect already, Goldman Sachs, his former company, would save about $1.5 billion a year under this plan. You look at the estate tax. Gary Cohn very loudly called for the elimination of the estate tax. He was quoted on Capitol Hill calling people morons if they actually paid it. This plan eliminates the estate tax. Carried interest, that's a loophole that allows people in private equity, hedge fund managers who might make $100 million a year, pay a lower tax rate than their administrative assistants. That goes unmentioned here. Candidate Trump promised to get rid of the carried interest. There's no talk of it here. I doubt we're going to get rid of the carried interest. Last one, the alternative minimum tax. There was it's kind of a safety net for the very wealthy. You could take your loopholes, but you have to pay some taxes. Donald Trump in 2005, the one year we know, paid $31 million because of the alternative minimum tax. That too would be eliminated.
Gary Cohn, corporatist, Democrat, globalist, in charge of taxes at the White House. We'll see how the populists in President Trump's political base react. Gary Rivlin with The Intercept, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick. Americans are paying close attention to Puerto Rico now. It's all over the news at night, and the military is mobilized and bringing aid to the island. All of that attention after a Category 4 hurricane to many Puerto Ricans seemed to get started slowly. A lot of them spent days after the storm struggling to get the suffering of friends and family on the island noticed. And many are wondering what the future will be like now for Puerto Rico after the wrecked houses are cleared and power is finally restored. Esmeralda Santiago left Puerto Rico for New York in 1961 when she was only 13 years old. Since then, the island has stayed with her through language and culture and her work. As a writer living in New York today, Esmeralda Santiago is a kind of cultural ambassador for the identity and the spirit of Puerto Rico. Santiago is the author of the books When I Was Puerto Rican and Conquistadora, and she joins me now to talk about how she's been thinking about recent events in Puerto Rico. Esmeralda, thanks for being with us.
Muchas gracias. Hola. I'm very happy to be here.
Hola to you as well. Esmeralda, we've been hearing so much from Puerto Rican people on this show over the last week. Policymakers, people with family and friends with no contact on the island, people who've watched their homes and their island wiped out. What have you been thinking about over this last week?
I have been thinking about nothing but Puerto Rico and its people. It's been a very difficult thing to be across the Atlantic and to hear and see and worry and fantasize and panic about what's going on there and feeling completely helpless because I can't help from here. It's been very, very emotional for me and for the millions of Puerto Ricans who are away from the island, but who still have a lot of family and friends there. And we know what's going on, and we want to help.
And what about your family? Are they all right?
Thank you for asking. My family is safe. They were evacuated. They have been flooded. They're staying with friends. And I still have not heard from my elderly aunt and my cousins. That has been one of my big worries. I just have not been able to get in touch with any of them. But I hope that they're okay.
This is one of the times, Esmeralda Santiago, when people might expect you to be writing, because you're famous for it and famous for reflecting the Puerto Rican experience through your writing. Have you been able to do it?
I have not been able to write a word except in my journals, my frustration and my fears and my concerns for my Puerto Rican people on the island. It's just difficult to focus on anything but trying to find information and speaking to my friends. And I have to be honest. I mean, I've been very, very lucky that many of my friends here in the United States, they reached out. People that I have not heard from years have reached out to me to say, what can we do? How can we help? And that has been a comfort. But my writing is really, it's on the back burner for now.
Well, Puerto Rico has a lot of stories, of course, but one of the main ones is diaspora, and you've included it in your art, and you've lived it. Millions of Puerto Ricans are here on the mainland, with millions more back home. 80,000 more leave every year. What is in store for the spirit of Puerto Rican people now, given the devastation of this storm, do you think?
The Puerto Ricans that I see and that I speak to are so optimistic, and they are looking forward to making things better than before the hurricane. And we are optimistic and generous. The many, many situations that I have observed, that I've been told about, that I read about, are neighbors helping neighbors, a young man carrying an elderly lady who is wheelchair-bound and is trying to get her out of her flooded home. These kinds of visions of my people just make me so, so emotional and so proud, because they really, they're doing everything that they can to make things better, always with this vision that things are going to get better. And that optimism is very, very encouraging, even as it breaks your heart, because you see how much work there is ahead of them.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the future of the island, because we've had so many experts on this show over the last several weeks describe the Puerto Rican diaspora that you write about. And devastation like this only pushes more people, the people who have money for plane tickets, to the mainland, off the island. Is there a threat there for the future of Puerto Rico if so many more people might leave?
I don't know any Puerto Ricans who have left the island who don't have a dream of returning to the Puerto Rico that they left. That is certainly my case. That is the case of everyone that I know who are Puerto Ricans and were born there, or whose parents were born there. And there's always this dream of going back and living there, because we have a very, very big attachment to this small island. And that's our plan, really. It's my plan, even though I have not been able to accomplish it. And given this situation, it's going to be very difficult to imagine the little finquita in the countryside of Puerto Rico. But I do believe that those of us here will make every effort to go back. And one of the things that I have been encouraging the people who follow me on my social media is, if you have a vacation coming up, this is where you should consider going. Maybe things are not going to be as comfortable as they were before the hurricane, but people there need jobs. They need a sense that we care about them. We need your dollars so that they can help themselves, so that they can rebuild their homes, so that they can rebuild the island structure. And I do hope that the diaspora will respond, because we will be the first line of the rebuilding of the island.
Well, Esmeralda Santiago, we're grateful that you've taken this time to spend with us during a very difficult moment for you and for your family. So thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. Muchas gracias.
Author Esmeralda Santiago. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. Tonight in the NFL, the Green Bay Packers face off against the Chicago Bears at Lambeau Field. And this time, star quarterback Aaron Rodgers and his Packers teammates are asking fans in the stands to join the team and link arms during the national anthem. Here's Aaron Rodgers addressing his team's handling of the protests after last Sunday's game, when most players locked arms and three sat on the bench while the national anthem played.
There's been a lot of hatred on my social media, probably other people's social medias, I'm sure, as well. Frankly, don't understand it. It's never been about military or men and women in uniforms. This is about equality.
This is about equality, says Aaron Rodgers, but a fight for equality by some is still seen as a sign of disrespect by others. Some of you, in fact, our listeners, feel that way.
Craig Ward, Morganville, New Jersey. I think there is everything right with free speech, but not when you're on the job getting paid millions of dollars. These athletes have the privilege of being heard, and they should do it someplace else, not at the game where they're getting paid too much money, in my opinion.
Just because we have the right to do something doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. It's disrespectful to our flag to kneel. It just is.
Well, all this week, we've been talking about protest and patriotism, and we want to continue that now with Rich Lowry. He's the editor of the conservative magazine and website, The National Review. Rich, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Rich, you've been watching these protests with everybody else, the reaction, the president stoking the controversy, using it to rally his political base. Aaron Rodgers says this isn't about the flag or the anthem or the military. It's about equality. How do you respond to that? And what have you been thinking about during this week?
Yeah, I don't really buy that argument. I know what he's getting at, but it's a little bit like saying someone during the Vietnam War saying, oh, I burned the American flag. But it's not about the American flag. It's about the war. Burning the flag, when you're disrespecting the flag, it becomes about the flag. And I agree with the caller who said, just because you have a right to something, do something, doesn't mean that you should do it or that it's right to do it. So these players have a free speech right. They have every right to highlight issues of police brutality as they see it. Just don't do it by kneeling during the national anthem. You can kneel any other time. You can use interviews and Twitter to say what you want. You can call President Trump a bum, you know, the way LeBron James did. But don't disrespect the flag. One, because it's wrong. And two, just for your own purposes, it's not helping your cause. Because protest movements usually are best served by appropriating and embracing America's basic national symbols rather than slighting them.
Well, Rich Lowry, even if the protests are offensive or difficult, isn't that part of the point, though? I mean, Colin Kaepernick could have spoken out at a press conference and gotten 3 minutes on ESPN. I mean, he's not LeBron James, let's face it, in the sports world. This, from his perspective, seems to have been far, far more effective.
Still doesn't make it right, and I'm not sure whether it's really done his cause really any great favors. I mean, has it really advanced the cause of police reform? Has it just created a lot of controversy whether he should kneel or stand during the national anthem? I think it tends to be the latter. And again, I just feel very strongly the same sentiment. I wouldn't have put it in the same words as the President of the United States or as Chief of Staff, you know, John Kelly, who has a lot of credibility speaking to this, given his service and the sacrifice of his son, which is what we ask is kind of part of the privilege of citizenship in this country, is just you take 3 minutes just to stand up, think about the country, think about what you owe to it, what you owe to all those people who sacrificed to defend our freedoms during the playing of the national anthem. That's it. Then you can go about your business and do whatever you want. But that's just sort of a basic, minimal way we have of expressing gratitude and respect for this country.
Well, how important is that basic minimum to you in how you approach patriotism in general? How important is the symbology of the flag itself, the song, versus the value of American protest and social change?
Well, I think the symbols are very important. I think it's inherent to human nature that such symbols are important. You go back to Roman history, and when Roman legions lost their standards in battle It was considered a great shame, and the Romans would undertake great exertions to recover those standards no matter what, whether they did it diplomatically or militarily. And a lot of people rightly feel the same way about our flag. So just national symbols have always been very important, will always be very important. And again, there are other ways to register protest. I mean, this is the only country in the world that has a First Amendment, that has the widest sphere for free expression really of anywhere in the world, and people should take advantage of it. I just don't believe they should take advantage of it by disrespecting our national symbols. And you know, some of the most powerful images from the civil rights movement are people who were not afforded full citizenship in this country, who were denied, you know, the ideals of this nation, and they didn't reject the nation, they didn't stomp on the flag, they carried the flag as a statement, we are Americans too, and we deserve all the rights of Americans. And it was that kind of attitude that helped account for the success of the civil rights movement.
But Rich, one of the messages, and you heard it from one of our callers, in opposition to the protests at the NFL games, is that these players, you know, shouldn't be protesting at all. They should be grateful. They're rich. They're successful. They've made it in America. They don't really have a place to be decrying racial inequality. And the message seems to have been summarized in that phrase, shut up and play. Is that an appropriate response to somebody with the right to protest?
I think it's an understandable response in two senses. One, there are these, it's not part of the official rule book as I understand it, but there are these kind of guidelines for conduct that the NFL publishes. And in those guidelines, it says stand up during the anthem, you know, put your right hand over your heart the way everyone does, and don't display any political messages on the field. All that's inappropriate. And I think those guidelines are sound. It is inappropriate. People do not want to have politics shoved in their faces when we're watching a game on Sunday or Monday or Thursday. You know, there are very few days when you can't see an NFL game now. And, you know, kneeling during the national anthem is a political message that I think is left somewhere besides the field. And then I think the caller is right. These men, you know, they've worked very hard. They're extremely disciplined to have gotten where they are, but they also, in the American context, are incredibly privileged and blessed. You know, they're rich. Many of them are famous, and they've gotten rich and famous by playing a game. So again, it doesn't mean they shouldn't have political opinions. They shouldn't express themselves in various ways. But going back to the anthem, that's just standing for 3 minutes. It's just a minimal statement of gratitude for this country. And I think NFL players should feel that perhaps more than a lot of other people in the country.
But wouldn't you agree that protest is often most successful when the protesters don't play by the rules? I mean, isn't that one of the tenets of protest? Make it uncomfortable for the people who you view in power?
I don't think that this is going to succeed on its own terms. I mean, we're not talking about policing right now. We're talking about whether they should stand for the anthem. And that's sort of the grounds that this is being fought on.
Well, let's talk about let's talk about policing, Rich, because I wonder what you think has earned the most ire from people who don't like these protests. I mean, is it really the disrespect for the national anthem or the flag? Or is it the fact that the protest was police brutality, violence against people of color, or a combo of all three of those things? I mean, I've seen responses that are angry about combinations of those things.
I think it's mostly the anthem. And just that hits people emotionally. We feel an emotional attachment to the flag. And when fellow Americans seem to disrespect it, it's going to create a reaction.
But what did you think when the Dallas Cowboys played the other day and the owner of the Cowboys and the players knelt? They got booed by the crowd pretty loudly. They didn't do it during the national anthem. They did it separate from the national anthem. That was part of the point. The crowd still booed.
Yeah, I think that what the Cowboys did is a pretty good compromise. I wouldn't be kneeling at all on the field just because I don't think it's a great place to make political statements, but you're not disrespecting the flag. And I think that's really the red line. And I think the crowd there might have been confused a little bit about what they were doing. And two, just might be primed, given that so much of the kneeling has happened during the anthem, to just reject kneeling altogether.
Well, Rich Lowry, we've been asking people all this week this question, and I'll put it to you. What's your definition of patriotism?
It's loyalty to the country and to its ideals. And American patriotism is a dynamic force. It's not ever satisfied just with the current state of affairs. You know, it has an ideal set out in the Declaration of Independence that we always should be striving for, but it's just a certain basic level attachment to the nation that everyone, left, right, communist, anarchist, should feel for this country, because none of us chose to be born here. It's just an incredible blessing to be an American. You know, all of us would be different and would have much less wealth and freedoms if we were born in other countries in the world. So when you get a great gift that you're not responsible for, the appropriate response is gratitude. And I think that's really at the bottom of patriotism.
Rich Lowry, editor of the National Review. Thanks for being here, Rich.
Thanks so much.
They say that breaking up is hard to do. Now I know that it's true.
Britain formally notified the European Union about its decision to split from the EU 6 months ago. That means complicated divorce negotiations, and on that front, there has been very little progress. Negotiators from both sides are hoping to break the deadlock with a fourth round of Brexit talks in Brussels this week. Paul Copeland is an associate professor of public policy at Queen Mary University of London, and he's been following the Brexit negotiations.
At this very moment in time, I would say that the situation around the negotiations is exactly where we were several months ago, if not 15 months ago. In other words, the government in London and Prime Minister Theresa May finds itself in an incredibly difficult situation. What it wants from the negotiations and what has been promised to the British public that the UK can get from the negotiations, the EU is not prepared to offer and not prepared to make a deal. So it's not looking good. The situation is one of stalemate, but it's one that ultimately favours the EU over the UK.
Meanwhile, Prime Minister Theresa May herself has proposed a 2-year transition period for the Brexit here. Has that helped ease things at all, made them maybe more realistic in the minds of negotiators and members of the public who are watching these talks?
I think in terms of what she's proposed, when it comes to Brussels and the individuals such as the EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, there's actually an awful lot of frustration around her announcement on Friday of a 2-year transitional deal. The reason being is that the EU has said that it will not discuss a transitional deal and the UK's future relationship with the EU until there has been solid concrete agreements around the three areas that are being negotiated at the moment. So the budget, the rights of EU citizens, and the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic. When it comes to the public, I don't think the British public has thought that much about a transitional deal. It's clever on the one hand. It speaks to the public and prepares them for Brexit negotiations to go beyond 2 years, which they possibly can. But meanwhile, it is irritating EU leaders that the UK is not keeping to the script.
On the other hand, a 2-year transitional deal, whether Brits are keyed into the details or not, could be seen as a lack of resolve, right? I mean, lots of people in the UK voted for this. Now they're seeing stagnation. They're seeing a deal not getting done. And what you've described as a bunch of overpromising.
Yeah, exactly. So I think there is a real issue here for the Prime Minister and the Conservative Party that which she is the leader of. The issue is that all sorts of promises have been made that the UK could have access to the single market once it left the EU. It wouldn't have to then pay into the EU's budget, and it could also close its borders and not accept free movement of people. The problem is that the UK now finds itself in a situation whereby none of that can be delivered. In other words, fairly clear that you cannot have access to the single market without accepting free movement of people, without having to pay into the EU's budget. So there's frustration from that side. There's frustration from the hard Brexiteers, as it were, because they feel like the Brexit is not being delivered. Meanwhile, when it comes to individual soft Brexiteers who, for example, want the UK to stay in the single market and are happy to accept free movement and are happy to pay into the EU's budget, the question then becomes, well, why didn't you just stay in the EU anyway? Because you're kind of part of this whole process, but you're not involved in the decision making.
Paul Copeland, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Paul Copeland is Associate Professor of Public Policy at Queen Mary University of London.
The Takeaway is supported by Indeed.com, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings, review candidates, take notes, and schedule interviews from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com. And LegalZoom.com, providing American business owners with legal advice through its network of independent attorneys available in all 50 states. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway.
Let's go back to Puerto Rico now, because amid the calls for swifter aid to Puerto Rico after the hurricane, a decades-old piece of maritime policy became a big point of contention for the White House. The 1920 Jones Act, it requires that goods shipped between U.S. ports be shipped on U.S.-flagged vessels. That means American-made ships owned by American firms, staffed by American sailors. The Jones Act was waived after Harvey and Irma to bring relief more quickly with fewer restrictions, and up until yesterday, the same had not been done for Puerto Rico. Finally, today, the White House did announce that the president would waive the Jones Act for Puerto Rico. To give us an understanding of this old policy and why we have it, Walter Olson from the Cato Institute. Walter Olson, welcome.
Thank you.
What was the purpose of the Jones Act originally? Why do we have it?
The idea was to preserve a merchant marine in American hands. It might be important in case of war or emergency. Since then, a lot has changed, and we have a much, much smaller merchant marine, and in particular, the sector protected by the Jones Act is an odd little sector. It's mostly transport between the U.S. mainland and islands.
And so the legal prescription that it has to be U.S. ships, U.S. crews, what was the purpose of that part of it? I mean, is it strictly protectionism for U.S. shipping?
It is protectionism for U.S. shipping and indirectly for U.S. shipbuilding, because the ships have to be made in the U.S. And protectionism always has its cost. And sometimes the costs are spread widely. In the case of the Jones Act, the costs fall somewhat randomly and often very narrowly. They make things much more expensive in Hawaii, for example, and in Puerto Rico. In a lot of the country, you don't especially notice that you aren't getting goods this way. But for people whose only shipping options are dominated by the Jones Act, it can mean, as in Puerto Rico, that shipping costs to the mainland are double what they would be otherwise.
So the Jones Act was waived, as we mentioned, for Harvey and for Irma. And then people started asking questions of the White House, well, why hasn't it been waived in Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Maria? The president said yesterday that he was considering waiving the Jones Act, but that shippers and the shipping industry didn't want it, Walter Olson. That was sort of a surprising moment of candor from the president, it seemed.
It was, but the fact is that the reason we still have a Jones Act and the reason it is guarded so jealously in Washington as a political thing is that there is a lot of money at stake in, call it a monopoly, if you will, in the lack of competition on those routes. And the companies that make money in that, some of the unions involved, worry that if free competition were let in, they would not win that competition. They would lose a lot of business to whoever had lower costs and more efficient service.
So now that the White House has waived the Jones Act in this case, what does that mean for people on the ground in Puerto Rico? Does it simply mean the goods that come in, the relief goods, are going to be cheaper?
It's good news in the short run, but two things to keep in mind. One is that they are still trying to reopen the ports. And so the importance of the Jones Act waiver will be especially after we've got some working access to the ports, at which point many more kinds of goods can come in from more places. The other question is whether or not this will be a lasting waiver. White House was talking about doing it only for 10 days. That's not going to make much of a difference. A lot of the building materials that have to come in if people are to reconstruct their houses, a lot of the utility materials are not going to be there within 10 days. Question is then whether Puerto Rico will have to rebuild at some of the world's most expensive rates or whether it can rebuild at reasonable competitive rates.
Goods will now be cheaper in Puerto Rico thanks to the White House waiving the Jones Act. The question, according to Walter Olson, how long will that waiver last? And will it last throughout the recovery efforts in Puerto Rico after Maria? Walter Olson, senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick. We have a look now at the rise of personal bankruptcy among African Americans in the South. A new investigation out this week shows that African Americans who file for bankruptcy in the South have a harder time getting out of debt than white filers do. And the difference is not necessarily how much money they make. Instead, the investigation from ProPublica found that African Americans are more likely to file for Chapter 13 bankruptcy than other kinds of bankruptcy. They're often lured by bankruptcy attorneys with zero money down plans for getting out of debt. That starts a cycle of debt relief, but on credit, that's often very hard to pay off. And it's led to a pattern of revolving debt among people living paycheck to paycheck. Paul Keel is a reporter at ProPublica who writes about consumer finance. His investigation, he says, helps illustrate how the system of bankruptcy is failing African Americans. Paul Keel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You say in your report that Memphis, Tennessee, has become the bankruptcy capital of the United States. Why?
It has the highest per capita filing rate in the country, and it's been the way for quite a long time. Looking back, doing the research for the story, I saw news stories about this, you know, in the past, and there was sort of this idea that, well, people are filing bankruptcy a lot there. It must be that people just don't want to pay their debts there, or, you know, the sort of dismissive way of looking at it when it has a lot to do with the way bankruptcy has been practiced in the South for generations. It's just simply different from the way it is in the rest of the country.
Why are people going into bankruptcy in this part of the country? What are the main causes?
Well, we found in Memphis is a lot of cars. People have a car they're trying to hold on to. In Memphis, you really can't live without a car. The public transportation system's not great. So that's probably the main form of debt we found. You know, and it's a lot of subprime auto loans out there that are way overpriced vehicles, and so people are just trying to hold on to their car. And then the really stark thing in Memphis is a lot of people are filing bankruptcy just to keep the lights on. The utility is going to shut their lights off because they're behind on their bill, and getting into a bankruptcy at least will stop that.
One of the people profiled in your piece is Navasha Miller. Let's hear from her.
I cried, stressing at work, couldn't work, trying to figure out what to do. Because I know when they garnish people check, it be a lot. And I'm really not making nothing. I'm living from paycheck to paycheck, you know, so I just had to do what I had to do.
Is her story typical of the people that you found?
Yeah, she's really typical in terms of what income level she's at. She earns about $9 an hour working for this sort of like a temp type job. So that's the type of income level that people are going into the system. It's an income at which people are making just enough to get by. But if anything goes wrong, you know, they're knocked off path and are end up in a situation like where she's facing losing a quarter of her paycheck to a wage garnishment from her prior apartment. There are a lot of problems with roaches and bed bugs. She moved out. She broke her lease. And then the landlord came after her and was going to garnish her for the rent that she didn't pay after she moved out. So it's a situation where someone's desperate and she's trying to, you know, keep enough money to keep her lights on, to pay her rent. She's got three kids. And so bankruptcy is, you know, one solution to that. It'll stop the garnishment immediately.
So one of the bottom lines of your story, Paul Keel, is that even when you control, though, for income, geography, other factors, sort of all things being equal, African Americans get out of bankruptcy less frequently than white filers do. Why?
In this country, there are large income gaps along racial lines, but even larger is the gap along asset lines or wealth lines. So the typical white family has 13 times more wealth than a typical black family. It's just a yawning gap. So that means that there's been a lot of research to show that when some sort of financial emergency happens, there's just less of a reserve available for people to deal with it. And of course, people who are facing bankruptcy are going to be people who've face some sort of financial emergency. And what a lot of people don't realize when they think about bankruptcy is it's not free to hire an attorney. You got to hire an attorney if you want to do it well. And the reason that Chapter 13 is so popular in the South is the way it's been set up over time is attorneys will offer their services for $0. And Chapter 13 is typically a five-year plan. So you're paying on your debts over 5 years. And that's how the attorney is going to get his fee through those payments stretched over time. So the fee ends up being larger than the main alternative, which is Chapter 7, which almost every case is going to result in debt relief within a couple of months. But in a Chapter 7, usually you have to come up with around $1,000 to pay your debtor attorney.
So this is a key factor in your story, Chapter 13 versus Chapter 7. And we don't want to get too far into the details of bankruptcy law. But it's really that sort of $1,000 up front, you're saying, that's leading people to Chapter 13 more than Chapter 7. And that makes it harder to get out of debt.
Yeah, that seems to be a key bar. And when we looked at statistics nationally, so, you know, a long time people have realized that Chapter 13 is popular in the South and there's just been sort of, you know, a shoulder shrug and say, well, I guess that's just the way they do it down there. But when you look in the South in terms of who's going that path, it's lower income people as opposed to outside the South. 13 is used very selectively, mostly by middle income homeowners who are facing foreclosure, which is a really legitimate use of Chapter 13. But that's not the way it's used in the South.
Is there no way for attorneys in the South, despite this cultural difference, to steer people toward Chapter 7, which might be better for them, and still get paid their lawyer's fees?
So one thing we hope comes out of this piece is more reflection in the legal community down there in terms of, you know, as we show, there are attorneys who are more flexible and they are able to do more Chapter 7s for clients, and their clients are getting out of debt instead of just, you know, cycling over and over again. So it's just something that has not gotten a lot of attention and should get more attention.
Efforts to change the culture of bankruptcy in the South, particularly among African Americans in the South. Paul Keel with ProPublica. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Well, we want to keep hearing your take on patriotism. You can always call us and leave a message at 8778-MY-TAKE. But remember, you can also get an early jump on all of the conversations that you hear on the show here by signing up for our Listener Response Network. Text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. As always, standard data and messaging rates apply. And you can opt out by texting the word STOP at any time. Thanks so much for listening. In the meanwhile, I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.